The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
America, bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, broadcasting today from the heart of the Beltway, where the American Legislative Exchange Council is gathering for a couple of days of meetings. I'm honored to be back at ALEC, and that's the nickname for it, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, because then I find out what's going on at the state level with state legislators. They'll be in and out of the room all morning long. Let me run down the news for you very quickly. The United States beat Iran. Did I tell you the United States beat Iran? That's what I like the most. But then let's get on to the news. Yesterday on this program, I inveighed against Apple threatening to remove Twitter from the App Store. And I'm glad to set the stage. I'm glad to lead the way. But when the hammer came down, it was Ron DeSantis yesterday hitting in the afternoon in a speech Apple for threatening to remove Twitter. Cut number 19, the governor of Florida.
And then as you've seen that go on in China, you know, there's reports that Apple is not allowing the protesters to use this airdrop function where they're trying to communicate. That obviously is providing aid and comfort to the CCP. And so you see that report, and that's very concerning. And then when you also hear reports that Apple is threatening to remove Twitter from the App Store, because Elon Musk is actually opening it up for free speech and is restoring a lot of accounts that were unfairly and illegitimately suspended for putting out accurate information about COVID. That's like one of the main things that's being reinstated. So many things these experts were wrong at, and you had people on Twitter that were calling that out. And Twitter, the old regime in Twitter, their response was to try to just suffocate the dissent. And Elon Musk knows that's not a winning formula, and so he's providing free speech. And so if Apple responds to that by nuking them from the App Store, you know, I think that that would be a huge, huge mistake, and it would be a really raw exercise of monopolistic power that I think would merit a response from the United States Congress. And so don't be a vassal of the CCP on one hand and then use your corporate power in the United States on the other to suffocate Americans and try to suppress their right to express themselves. And so I'm glad things are changing at Twitter. And I know there's a lot of work to do with big tech generally, but this is big progress, and we're really happy that that is now happening.
Don't be a vassal of the CCP and then try and close down free speech in the United States. That is such an appropriate statement by Ron DeSantis. I wanted to lead the show with it. I was on Special Report last night, and I got a nice softball from Trace Gallagher, who's sitting in for Brett Baer last night. It's not really a softball, but it gave me a chance to stand up on my anti-Chinese Communist Party platform. Here it is, cut 22, after I'm being asked about the COVID protests in China. Cut 22.
I mean, Hugh, you look at what's happening here, and China is certainly not reticent at all to criticize the United States. If the United States disagree with this zero COVID policy, why not let it be known to everybody?
Shame on every part of the Biden administration for their silence here. They were silent when Hong Kong was put under the thumb. They were silent when 1 million Uyghurs are put into concentration camps. They have been silent over the suppression of the Catholic Church in China. They are now silent as people are hustled away into taxi cabs and little bits of freedom going through. We get to see little glimpses of former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo tonight tweeted less than an hour ago, "We stand with the Chinese people." I'd like to hear the president say that, because that is, in fact, what the American people believe. We ought not to be kowtowing to China, regardless of how much we need them to be the world's factory. No, you're not going to hear Joe Biden say that. Instead, you're going to hear Joe Biden go up to Michigan yesterday and say this. Cut number 5.
It's going to take time to get inflation back to normal levels as we keep the job market resilient. And we could see setbacks along the way.
Meaning inflation is coming and the recession is here. He continued, cut number 6.
10 years ago, how many knew what the hell the supply chain was? No, I'm serious.
I'm serious, too. They need to have the interpreter doing it for the deaf people. sign out, "We are screwed." Every time he talks, all they need to do is, "We are screwed," and do whatever it takes to prove that. I want to go back up now to the Kevin McCarthy coming out of the White House yesterday. There was a meeting there yesterday, and he also brought up going after Elon Musk for his free speech. Cut number three.
That is offensive to me. Government's going to go after someone that wants to have free speech? What do they have to look at Twitter about? Do they want to go more after American public about whether they can have an opinion on something? I think the American public have spoken on this. I think our First Amendment stands up, and I think they should stop picking on Elon Musk. You know, Elon Musk has succeeded in many places. I'd bet on him more than government going after you. And one thing I would say when we talk about accountability, we'll no longer let government go after people simply because of their political views.
Yeah, I hope that is the case. And I think that the Republican House will do that. I also got a question about the meeting at the White House yesterday, convened allegedly to head off a railroad strike. But they also talked about, are we going to do a continuing resolution? Bad idea. An omnibus? Good idea. Cut 21.
The GDP, $156 billion, 700,000 jobs. And then you've got prices going up another 4%, which we do not need. Hugh, this is a significant economic blow, and it comes during the holidays. Your thoughts?
And that's why I think you've got three Democrats and two Republicans saying they will stop it. They will get the Congress to pass and intervene. And even the most pro-union president ever, as he likes to call himself, Joe Biden, is going to urge that Congress get involved to stop this. If the railroads stop rolling at this point, all the supply chain malfunctions that we've seen for the past 3 years will only intensify. So that was a bit of good news coming out of the White House today, and Congress looks like they will get involved. Kevin McCarthy commented as he exited the meeting. The two Republicans are Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy. The three Democrats are Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, and, of course, Chuck Schumer. McCarthy, on exiting the White House, said this to the microphone. Cut one.
No, we went one other time at the 100-day mark, but since then we've never been back together. And the reason why he called us down is because he once again intentionally misled us. He said he had a rail strike solved when in September. When he knew that he didn't want the American public to know before the election that he didn't. Remember what he told us, that inflation was transitory. Remember he told us that the influx of illegals was seasonal, that the Taliban wouldn't take over Afghanistan. Again and again. But now we're just weeks away from the busiest season of the entire year of Christmas. And our whole infrastructure can shut down based upon this administration's negotiation with the rail, this pro-union individual who has failed once again. And he's asking government to step in to try to solve this problem, but he's begging the House and Senate to do it, just to take the bill up tomorrow when people have not even read it.
And so they will get that done. There won't be a rail strike because it would be a disaster for the country. Final cut from special report last night. There's an argument at the Supreme Court yesterday, 2.5 hours on whether or not Texas and Louisiana can sue the Secretary of HHS for failing to enforce the law as it is written. It's very complicated to try and explain a Supreme Court case in a minute. So I took a minute and a half on special report last night. Cut number 23.
But if you go back, Hugh Hewitt, to September of 2021, you had Secretary Mayorkas, right, in his memo, and he says the following, quoting here, "The majority of the more than 11 million undocumented or otherwise removable non-citizens in the United States have been contributing members of our communities across the country for years. The fact an individual is a removable non-citizen will not alone be the basis of an enforcement action against them. The department's personnel are to use their discretion and focus the department's enforcement resources in a more targeted way." And then you look at ICE deportations over the past 3 years. I mean, look at the number right there, 69,000, bottom right hand. And look at the early number, 267,000. Hugh Hewitt, there's almost 300% drop in deportations. So they clearly have chosen not to follow federal immigration law.
The memorandum that the secretary put out at the heart of this case poses the complex question of what does shall mean in this statute that they're debating today. there's three parts before the court, Trace, and it looks to me like there's six votes to say that Texas, Louisiana, and other states can sue. And they'll probably get a majority to say that shall means shall do as much as you can. But the remedy, which the Chief Justice kept coming back to, and Justice Kavanaugh as well, what do we do if we tell you the memorandum was wrongfully issued? What's going to happen? Because we can't make ICE do things. It's just up to the Supreme Court to say what the law is. The law is going to say, I think, that that memorandum was inappropriately issued. But after that's done, the court can't order ICE on a day-to-day basis to go round up people. So we'll be back where we started with a slap on the wrist for the administration, I think.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt from the ALEC Conference in the heart of Washington, D.C. Good morning to you all getting up, and you're wondering, what is ALEC? Jonathan Williams, the Executive Vice President at ALEC, is here. It's the American Legislative Exchange Council. Good morning, Jonathan. Welcome back. I last saw you in Atlanta,
yes.
So it's good to see you again. I was just telling you during the break, we've added affiliates since we were together. Let's start at the baseline. What is ALEC?
Well, great to see you again, Hugh, and good to have you back here in the land of make-believe this time in Washington, D.C. But, you know, ALEC is focused about outside of this beltway, outside of the land of make-believe in the 50 states. And we believe in the ideas of free markets and limited government and federalism. And we are really America's largest membership organization for state legislators. So those more than 7,000 individuals who serve in their one of their 50 state capitals across our laboratories of democracy, we have them join us, Republican, Democrat, Independent, Libertarian, Vegetarian. We don't care the partisan affiliation, but they're devoted to these principles that we've been talking about and wanting to make their state better.
The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, can be found at alec.org, A-L-E-C.org. Where did it come from? Who started it? When did it get started? Lisa Nelson will be in later, your CEO, but tell us about the origin story.
It's a really interesting origin story. And a lot of people, it's a conservative free market organization, would never think that we were founded just outside of Chicago by O'Hare Airport. By at the time in 1973, when we were founded, as we're going to celebrate our 50th anniversary next year, Hugh, we invite you to here into Washington to celebrate in October of 2023. But one of the people who hosted us was then the majority leader, believe this, is a Republican in Illinois, Henry Hyde.
Oh, he was the majority leader of the Illinois legislature, the great late Henry Hyde.
Indeed. And so we met in his district just outside of O'Hare Airport. And we brought in people like from my home state, Michigan. I know that's a whole other discussion for you.
Don't even
this week.
Bring that up. All right. No. We by the way, the College Football Playoff Committee last night ranked Ohio State 5. If USC loses, go Utes. I'm all of a sudden, is it Utes or Utes? I'm not sure.
Utes, I think.
Utes. Yeah. I'm all in for the Utes. Just beat the living daylights out of the Trojans. But go ahead. So you went to Illinois in 73.
Yes, and then they wanted to build a conservative caucus for state legislators to say, what for those of us who believe in conservative ideas, what kind of resources are there for us to exchange best practices and talk about real policy solutions for the states? And so Henry Hyde and from Michigan, John Engler, who's a freshman state legislator at the time in 1973, went on to become a three-term governor, of course.
Michigan, yeah.
Tommy Thompson in Wisconsin, Terry Branstad in Iowa. You're going to talk to my good friend John Wills, Speaker Pro Tem, here in the next segment, I think, from Iowa. And so you had a huge Midwestern presence, but then they attracted legislators from all across the country to buy into this vision that the states need to lead on policy, trusted policy ideas that make the lives of people better all across America.
Now, your makeup must change every 2 years, or maybe even every year, because places like Virginia, New Jersey have funny elections, so there's always a little. What did the elections do to the state legislatures? I think the Democrats flipped three chambers out of 99 chambers. Am I right about that, if I got it correct?
They're still counting in some places.
Alaska will never
out, right?
be done. They'll be done by the time the next election comes up.
We've got a few from Alaska with us this week on site, and they do not know who's going to be organizing that chamber in the Alaska House. But, you know, it's Michigan, both houses flipped to the Democrats. First time in 40 years, Democrats will run the state
after
of Michigan.
Their shutdowns, John?
It's a head-scratcher, right? I mean, you had Gretchen Whitmer telling people that they were unessential, and businesses and even outdoor businesses like pool cleaners and landscapers were told that they couldn't operate during the pandemic. And it just beats me and how in the world that she was able to get away with that.
You know, there is something called a false positive in the world of medical science where you get a false positive and you think, I got to run that test again. Gretchen Whitmer is the country's worst governor. And so given the way that she governed during the shutdown, So when they won and they flipped those chambers, you know, that means Michigan's going to the dark ages and Harbaugh's still their coach. So it's really dreadful. But where did the Republicans hold ground everywhere else?
Pretty much. And they gained ground in a lot of places. You're going to talk about Iowa here. There was a red wave in Iowa led by Kim Reynolds and John Wills and our good friends there. There was certainly a red wave in Florida with Ron DeSantis. There was a red wave in a lot of states, so Ohio being one of them.
Yes.
I think that's going to see very conservative governance now coming out. Great new Speaker of the House, who's an ALEC member, Derek Marin.
And in fact, I've already heard from the Center for Christian Virtues, Aaron Bear, that they expect their backpack bill to fly through. And I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about education today. So when you get them together after an election, are they here to celebrate? Or are they here to get an agenda? What do they do here?
Well, they're here, to learn and to hear what's going on around the other states, to hear if the problems that they're facing are common. And chances are they probably are. The inflation issue is hitting everybody still, you know, hard. And now, you know, the issue of overspending, the issue of these states that are now seeing a downturn in revenue because of Joe Biden's thumb on the economy federally and the war on energy and all the things that we've been seeing here is the land of make-believe in Congress. But I think when you look at what's going on in the states, and there's a great conservative energy, though, of how do we push back with principled policy solutions, pushing back against this radical ESG movement that you talk about, pushing back against the big government policies here in Washington. Because folks, look at the news from California that you probably reported on this week. California now facing a budget deficit after Gavin Newsom was parading around the country running for president, I guess, in some fairy tale approach to running for president, saying we have a surplus in California, so you should elect me president of the United States. Now that, of course, turns into a deficit. And you know why, Hugh? Numbers came out this week in California year over year. General fund spending alone in California grew in 1 year by 50%. $80 billion was added to the general fund of California last year. People are hearing numbers like that because of all the federal funds sloshing around in state budgets. They're worried about what's around the turn when it comes to the economy. And they're starting to figure out how do we continue to cut taxes, but also tighten our belts.
It is a failed state. I refer to California as a failed state. I don't know if you have any California state legislators here. But it is kind of sad to be in the California legislature right now because they don't know what to do, and their unfunded pension liabilities are extraordinary. I do want to focus on the upside, and my Iowa friends and I will be talking about school reform. Doug Ducey in the Arizona legislature, he's on his way out. They passed universal school choice. Are you going to track how that works for the benefit of other legislators?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the core functions of ALEC, and it's also now become a piece of ALEC model legislation based on Arizona, based on West Virginia, those two incredible universal school choice plans. And so we're going to be tracking that. We're going to be working with legislators to educate them. If they want to go down that path, which I think the vast majority of people here this week do want to replicate what just happened in Arizona and West Virginia, ALEC's going to be right alongside of them to help them be successful in those
approaches. I don't want to put you on the spot, but can you? I think I know what happened in Arizona. I do not know what happened in West Virginia. What is the model legislation that you propounded for the members of ALEC?
Well, basically, just a universal dollars follow the kids and follow the families. Up to 93%, I think, of total state aid in Arizona goes back to the families and to the children, and them decide whether it's public, private, homeschool, of their choice, the kind of education that they'd like to see for their kids. And so our model is basically pretty direct of Arizona and West Virginia.
Now, Governor DeWine told me, he's a good friend, that, you know, we got a lot of rural districts in Ohio, and they love their unified school districts. They love to bus the kids to somewhere. They're not going to be in a hurry to take that $6,000 or whatever it is. I think it's $6,000 in Arizona, and not. I don't think those rural schools are threatened by school choice. I think people will just take their voucher back to that rural high school. Is that what you think?
Bingo.
That's going to happen.
The school situation is good enough for the parents. They're going to stay there, right? There's no incentive to pick up and uproot and take your kids someplace else and build a new circle of friends and everything else if you don't need to, right? If your situation is good enough, you take the voucher and you go there.
How do the school administrators know how many people are going to be coming? That's the other thing that's difficult for a school budgeting that's a public school. They're used to getting a big dollop of money that gets prefigured in January. They're setting up for September school start. And they know how many people they have to hire. How do they do it when they don't know where the vouchers are going to come in or not?
That's a great question. And it's probably a very good question when you bring in Senator Rucker from West Virginia to talk about how they've done that. Because they've gone ahead, even a year ahead of Arizona on this. But I think there's some cushion, some padding where there's some funds set aside to make sure that people are held harmless if there's a huge, you know, wave and they don't anticipate that.
And there's and if there's a drop off, do they have to fire everyone? That'll be a question I'll ask these state legislators. In terms of fiscal restraint, that's really very difficult when you've been flooded by federal money for 3 years. And they have been flooded by federal money for 3 years. Did any of them bank it and endow it, or did they all spend it?
Oh, no. I mean, I think you see a great story coming out of this where a lot of folks have learned their lesson from a decade ago with the Obama dollars and the bailout of the states that happened. You know, we've been doing this long enough. We talked a lot about that 10 years ago. We said we warned against the strings that came out, the maintenance of effort requirements. And state legislators, I think very wisely, have looked to say, we can't replicate the mistakes from 10 years ago. And so you hear from John Wills here in a second from Iowa, you know, they've banked that and put it in a taxpayer relief fund and are looking at ways to prudently continue to reduce taxes and become more competitive, but make sure that it's not all spent.
That is a smart play. If you take federal money that's not allocated to a specific purpose and you put it in the bank, it becomes an endowment for your state. And I know that California will just, you know, hose the money down. But I look forward to talking to people about this. How many members are there of ALEC?
About 2,000 across the states.
And if someone is sitting here at home and wondering, I wonder if my legislator is a member, and they call them up and say, why aren't you an ALEC? And they say, well, it's too expensive, et cetera. Is it expensive for the state legislator to join?
It is the best deal in Washington, D.C., and that is $100 a year, the grand total of $100 a year for your state legislator to join and have all the resources that ALEC brings of policy education and consulting and coming out to your state capital to help them be successful.
That's a pretty good deal. You know, I go away for the summer, and we leave in our guest room up north, rich state, poor state. And people who stay there say, why do I have rich state, poor state? And I said, well, everyone's from somewhere else. I want you to know how your state compares to everyone. It's really the one best book to give everyone. Why is Florida, Tennessee, and other places like Texas booming? Why is California losing people? It's all in rich state, poor state. Is that available for download PDF?
It is. Well, that warms my heart to know that about your
people always
there.
Come in and they always look up their state. It's the best book to leave in a guest room because everyone looks up their state and they say, oh, gosh, I didn't know I was paying this much money. It's, you know, New Yorkers hate it. Oh, do they hate it when they're paying so much in property taxes?
Exactly. But the folks from Utah that have been number one for 15 years really love that book.
Go Utes. Beat USC. Beat USA. We just got to say that because are you a Michigander through and through?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Did you go to the U?
No, my dad did. Yes.
I'm sorry to hear that. Did he out of jail yet? No, okay. I went to the U. I'm a lawyer from the University of Michigan, but I treat Michigan like the Vikings treated England. Go in, get what's worth having, and leave. And so thank you, John, for coming back. In terms of how, this meeting versus the last one, what's the difference? We got about a minute.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the biggest differences is the vast majority of attendees on the legislator side, or at least a good number of them, are brand new for the first time. We just, the last couple of days, hosted a training just for first-time state legislators. And so we had hand-selected from our ALEC trusted network across the country individuals coming in for the very first time serving their states and coming in for 2 days of policy training to learn what does it mean to be a successful state legislator? What are the policy ideas that other states are looking at right now?
What a smart play.
And it's an incredible 53 of them just came for the last 2 days from 25 states to get this basic free market training.
$100
For $100 a year. That's deal in D.C.
Jonathan Williams, thank you. Executive Vice President of ALEC. When we come back, Rep. John Wills is going to be joining me. The Speaker Pro Tem. I always wonder about the Speaker Pro Tem. They're usually getting ready to push the Speaker off into a canyon or something like that. But we'll come back with that. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt at the ALEC Convening Conference in Washington, D.C., ALEC.org. I'm joined by Representative John Wills, the Speaker Pro Tem of the Iowa House. John, good morning. Great to have you back. It's good to see you again. There was not a red wave in the country, but there were red thunderstorms in various places. And you had a red flash flood in Iowa, right?
I would even say we maybe had a red tsunami. We did have a very good year.
And so what's the breakdown in the House and the Senate?
Well, the House has 63 members. We had 60. The Senate has 34. We had 32. And so both supermajorities in the House and the Senate.
So Iowa can do anything it wants.
Sure.
Okay. So I want to talk to you about education policy. But first, you're the Speaker Pro Tem. Who do we have to bump off to make you the Speaker?
Well, I really think that the Speaker right now is doing a great job, and so I think he should stay there. And
that's what you want to say if you don't want to be indicted, I know. But who do we? What's the name of the Speaker?
Speaker Pat Grassley.
All right, Pat, check your back. Okay. John Wells, tell me, what are you going to do on education policy?
Well, we really need to look at education in Iowa. So the speaker has formed a special committee in the House, and it's called the Education Reform Committee. It's made up of him, the majority leader, and myself, and then two Democrats. And so we're going to do some major reform on education this year, and we're serious about it.
Now, you heard me earlier say Governor DeWine is worried about rural schools and education reform. I have to assume Iowa's got the same issue.
Yeah, we're all worried about the rural schools because they can be affected very, very adversely by any major changes. And so we've got to be very cognizant of the fact that we could hurt our schools. So what we've got to do is make sure that what we do it does not affect our schools in a negative manner. I'm of the belief that if we do good things will happen even in the rural schools.
Now, when do you have a timeline set out for coming up with a formula for education?
Well, we start our session here in January, and so we're going to talk to our caucus. We're going to find out what we can accomplish, what we can't accomplish, and then we're going to set that agenda.
Now, in terms of a hybrid, which is, I think, what Governor DeWine was talking about, carving out school districts that are unified school districts that serve an entire county, can you do a carve-out? Is that on the table? Because you really got to get to Des Moines and to the other population centers where there might be a lot of opportunity for people to move around as opposed to a rural district where there's one school.
Right. Yeah. You know, you look at the makeup of schools in Iowa, I think 24% of the population has a private school close to them. And that's mostly in the urban areas. And so really, there's not a lot of choice for a lot of people. You know, hopefully if we can get things moving, we can have more kids be able to have access to private schools and other schools, other school choices. The parents deserve to have a choice.
And they might choose the public school.
Sure.
They might.
Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of the next thing up on the agenda, I hope education reform is number one. What's number two?
I'd say more tax reform. We've really been able to be very successful with tax reform over the last couple of years. Property taxes is a big issue. I think that's nationwide. I think
yeah.
Property taxes is a huge thing. And so we need to really look at that.
So I look at Tennessee, Texas, and Florida. They have no state income tax. What's Iowa's?
Well, we just passed a tax reform that our tax rate is going to go down to a flat rate of 3.9%. I think we were one of the first states in the nation this year to do that, and I think five or six additional states did it this year. So it's really kind of a wave kind of thing this year where lots of states are moving towards this flat tax.
Do you have an estate tax in Iowa?
We also eliminated our estate.
You see, this is to me the key thing is that property taxes are driving people out of their homes in New York. Estate taxes are driving people out of Washington State and Maine and other places like that. And when I read rich state, poor state, the ones who win are the ones who have low income tax, flat tax, you in Arizona or no tax, Texas. And we also look at whether or not they will take your money from your house. And so how do you, Prop 13 has been around in California, but it's so badly drawn, it's created adverse dysfunctional effects. People don't leave their homes. Are you working through the downside of Prop 13 as well as the upside of property tax reform?
Well, I think that we've got to. I think that they're kind of mutual. And so I think really we're going to look at all of those aspects and make sure that what we're doing doesn't adversely affect people regardless of where they're at.
Now, John, two people say different things. Some people say speed kills. Other people say speed thrills. I'm in the latter. I think legislators have to move fast. When when you get a vote of confidence in a red tsunami like that in Iowa, how quickly can your legislature roll out?
Well, you know, the governor won by 19%.
Wow. Kim Reynolds, right?
Kim Reynolds, and she ran on her major issue, education reform. And so she wants that to be the first bill that she is able to address this year. I think with the way that we've set it up in the House, where we have a five-person committee, we can really quickly get that that bill to the House floor, get it over to the Senate, or they can get theirs to us. We're going to get it as one of the first bills done.
All right. Now, the Iowa caucuses are only 13 months away. Who have you endorsed?
Well, we've had a lot of people visit Iowa who are interested. They're trying to raise their awareness. We'll see what happens over the next couple months.
Dwayne, was there an answer in there?
There was an answer.
There you go. Come and see me. That was basically all of you come and see me, right?
Was that a very political answer?
That was a very, very deft. It went right past me on both sides. I didn't know. But they ought to come and see John, right? They ought to come and see you.
We do not vote for people unless we see them, shake their hand, and understand who
they are. Who have you seen thus far?
Oh, Pompeo. I
think Mike's living there.
Yeah,
I think Mike
yeah,
Pompeo's basically living in Iowa. What do you think?
Tim Scott. There's quite a few people that have been there already.
Do you just leave like Wednesday night dinner with a would-be president open? Is that what it is?
Yeah. You know.
Iowa wins that way. Enjoy the ride. It's going to be a great 13 months. Call me when you learn something, will you?
It's going to be very fun. Thank
you. I'll be right back. America Hour number two from Alex. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway, indeed at the heart of the Beltway, where the American Legislative Exchange Council is meeting, alec.org. Now, their Iowa Speaker Pro Tem, John Wills, is still here in the event that Senator Patricia Rucker doesn't find us. John, you were just telling me about the election in Iowa, and the people ran on conservative issues, and you won on conservative issues.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The governor, everybody down the line ran on conservative issues, and we won on those conservative issues. And I really am a firm believer that, if you tell people what you believe and what you're going to do, and you actually do it, they'll support you.
Thank you so much, John, for hanging on, because Patricia Rucker, Senator Rucker, joined us now. The West Virginians operate on their own schedule. I know that. I'm from Ohio, and the West Virginians just tell you what to do. Slow down. Enjoy our beautiful state. John, thank you. Senator, welcome. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So I want to ask you right off the bat, West Virginia is the reddest state in the union. So, I mean, right? It's the most conservative state in the union. Did you win both houses of the legislature?
We definitely won both houses, and we increased our numbers in the legislature, in the House and the Senate. We also increased and won many races locally, too.
Okay. Now, last time I talked, you were busy doing school choice. Is school choice done, or is it about to be done?
No, it's definitely done. It became law after our Supreme Court decided to, you know, say, yes, it is definitely constitutional, thanks to our great attorney general and the great job he did. So it is now live, active, and happening.
Would you tell everyone in the country, especially those who are screwed over by a public school that is failing, how the West Virginia plan works?
So we have, of course, some of the basics of school choice. We have open enrollment, we have charter schools, but it's only just begun, very few options so far. But we passed an education savings account called the Hope Scholarship. That is, any student in West Virginia who attends public school and they're not getting what they need can apply to get the Hope Scholarship, and they will receive 100% of the state average. Money that the state provides for that student's education will go into a student's account for the parent to be able to control how and what their child best needs.
What can the parent do with that money? How much is that money, by the way? What's the average this year?
So this year, I think it's $3,600.
Okay, $3,600. In Arizona, I think it's about $6,000. It depends on which state you're in, population taxes, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
So they get $3,600 in their Hope Scholarship. How do they get that to a charter school or to a home school? How do they access the money?
Well, they don't need to spend it at charter schools, because charter schools are public schools.
Okay.
But if they want to attend a private school would have to be an eligible provider. There's a form they have to fill out, and then the money will go straight from this child's account to the school to pay for the tuition or supplies. If the parent wants to use it to buy computers or curriculum or anything that they need, that place that they want to purchase it from has to be an eligible provider, fills out the same form. The money will go directly from the student's account to pay for that.
So there's no potential for fraud. People cannot misuse the money. Impossible. Now, has it shown much? Have people begun to vote with their feet at the school level yet?
Well, I can tell you that, you know, it's kind of hard to judge when we had such a dramatic escape from the public education system due to, I think, COVID. But even before COVID, we had thousands of parents choosing something other than public education. So it's kind of hard to say right now this is because there is now this different option. But I think we're going to be keeping track, of course, of how many parents are choosing this option, this ESA, to see how it will help them. And in 2025, unless something changes, it's going to actually open up to every student in the state of West Virginia. And then at that point, you will no longer have to have attended public school at all. Every student is going to be eligible for the Hope Scholarship.
And that happens in the beginning of school year 2025.
Actually, it's based on the numbers of enrolled students in 2025. So it would begin the school year of 2026.
Okay. So now tell me a little bit about the biggest obstacle in Ohio, your neighboring state, is that there are some rural schools that serve the entire county. They're public schools. Everybody loves them. They can't imagine them going away. And Governor DeWine said, you know, we got to take care of these rural schools. What are you doing in West Virginia about them?
Well, So first, let me just explain that you can't get more rural than West Virginia.
Yeah, okay.
But so here's the facts. the rural counties do struggle with the number of students that they have, but what they struggle with is they cannot possibly do everything for everyone. And with the small population that they have, they cannot offer the courses that urban areas and places where there's just a high tax base, they can offer all these exciting programs and field trips. You can't expect that of a rural school that has maybe 400 students total.
Yeah.
And we have school districts in West Virginia where the total population, we're talking elementary, middle, and high school, is 400.
A unified school district for a county, right?
Yes. Yeah. So by giving this option to those parents who have the kids who have needs are not being met at the top of the spectrum and kids whose needs are not being met at the bottom of the spectrum, you're actually relieving some pressure from those rural schools, districts that could not possibly handle all those needs so that they can focus on the vast majority, which is 95%. In the middle, and they're able to take care of those kids better.
Let's talk about both ends of the spectrum there for a second. Let's say you've got Einstein Jr. has popped up in your family, and they are going to be a rocket scientist, and they're going to go to MIT, but they can't get calculus, and they can't get trig at the rural school district. What do? Do they go to a boarding school?
So we try to address these type of things by, you know, allowing for virtual charter schools so that they can enroll in an online charter school. And again, they wouldn't have to use the Hope Scholarship for that. That's all paid with public money that can offer courses and those type of things. But we discovered, first of all, those rural districts, poor internet, as you know, poor broadband issues. Second of all, online schooling doesn't work for everyone.
Right.
A lot of kids we discovered through the COVID pandemic really suffered. So by having availability to these funds, these parents can now decide, okay, I'm going to hire a private tutor, or I'm going to invest in a really high quality curriculum.
You just told me the answer I was hoping to hear. I didn't want to put tutors count.
Oh, absolutely.
So someone who wants to take on five students and make $15,000 by being a tutor to five students in a rural district and maybe spend 2 hours a day or 3 days a week with each of them, that will work? That qualifies if they're a provider?
That absolutely qualifies, and it's already happening.
So, you know, that's what's going to happen is that the market will evolve solutions very quickly once they know where to go. What about at the other end of the spectrum? You have a high-functioning, special-needs child, but they're on the spectrum, but they can't really expect a rural high school to take, or they've got auditory sensory deprivation of some sort. What happens with them?
I'm very familiar with this need because I had two children like this.
Okay.
So, you know, it's very difficult to be in a classroom of 25, 30 kids if you're either hypersensitive or hyposensitive. Either one is a real problem, and it's becoming more prevalent, unfortunately. But so here's the thing. The parent who before did not have a choice to teach them at home or to put them into a smaller setting now is going to have some help with that. Having said that, I will tell you one thing I would love to do, and it's a goal of mine, is that we increase the amount of funding for kids with certain needs and so that they get more than the state average. Because it is going to be a very low amount for those who have special needs.
So in Orange County, California, when I was living out there for many years until 2016, they opened up a magnet school for children on the spectrum where their waiting list is out the door and around the block. Yeah. And so I can imagine tutors of special needs children saying, well, I can go teach five of those kids and I can do that for $18,000 a year because I'm not going to do it full time. Is that available? How do they get accredited?
So again, you don't have to be accredited to be an eligible provider, but you know, there's certain things that we ask. You can't commit fraud. If there's a refund, it goes back in the student's account, not to the parent. And of course, you have to file as a business. You have to have a 501c3 filing or, you know, be a business. You're not just somebody saying, oh, I am a teacher and you have nothing to kind of protect you or protect the parents. Having said that, it's very relatively easy. And I do believe that the market will bring a whole lot of options to parents. And like I said, it's already happening right now. I know of a church that has opened its doors to two retired teachers who are teaching, I think it's 8 or 9 students in this very small environment, and it's different grades, and it's kind of like a one-room schoolhouse, and those kids and parents are loving it.
Oh, my goodness. That is true. Now, we got less than a minute. Senator Rucker, what else is on the agenda? You've already won school choice. What are you going to do this year?
Well, I haven't totally decided yet, but I will tell you that I do have many other interests, including trying to do something about the tax reform in the state of West Virginia.
Is the property tax there bad, too?
Not necessarily bad, but I believe we can still do better.
Ah, Senator Rucker, I love hearing that. Thank you for coming back and seeing me from the great state of West Virginia. I'll be right back, America, from the ALEC Conference in the heart of Washington, D.C. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Stay tuned.
Hey, everyone. This is Dwayne Patterson, producer of The Hugh Hewitt Show. I've known for a while now that there's been far too much of me here in the studio, and I finally needed to do something about my weight. My excuse was always that I couldn't follow a plan with the crazy schedule that I keep. I heard about PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition and how they customize their program for each client, and I decided to call. This was no problem for Rachel and the PhD team. They had me map out what my day looks like and created a plan to follow. And so far, I've lost 16 pounds already, and I'm just 2 weeks in, on the way to my goal of losing 45. Call PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition at 864-644-1900 and make your appointment for your consultation. The plan is simple. It's based on science and nutrition. There's no pills or injections, and they even include 80% of your food if you want it. Call them right now at 864-644-1900 or find them online at myphdweightloss.com and tell them you heard about it from Dwayne, the producer Hugh actually has on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt from the ALEC Conference in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining. ALEC, A-L-E-C.org, if you want to get their free study, rich state, poor state. We're talking about a rich state now, Oklahoma, at least on their rating. Senator Julie Daniels is here from Oklahoma. Good morning, Senator. Welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Morning, Hugh. Nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, we're on in Oklahoma City and other places throughout Oklahoma. Tell us, which part of the Sooner State are you from?
I'm from Bartlesville, Oklahoma. We're about 40 minutes away from Tulsa to the south. I represent three counties up in the northeastern part of the state.
Now, there's a new my kids are urging me to watch Tulsa with Sly Stallone, and it's about organized crime in Tulsa. Having been in Tulsa a few times, I don't think there's any organized crime in Tulsa, is there?
I think perhaps those issues exist in many places where we might not expect it. And so in terms of getting on top of things and trying to nip those things in the bud, I'm sure that the law enforcement and first responders in Tulsa are taking care of that. But yes, we in Bartlesville listen very carefully to what's happening in Tulsa because, of course, they're our airport city. They're our
Your
city to the
city,
south.
You
know. So we're far enough north not to be a part of the metro area, but certainly what goes on in Tulsa is important to us.
So tell us what went on in Oklahoma in November. How did the elections go? Was it a red thunderstorm there? Because no red wave swept over the country, but it did in Iowa and Florida and Ohio. What was Oklahoma's experience?
Well, in Oklahoma, we'd already had our red tornado. We are a supermajority Republican state now after a century of pretty much one-party rule. So my party's been sort of in charge of policy for, 15 or so years now. But in this particular race, there was some question as to whether our governor, Kevin Stitt, would be reelected by a very large margin. And there was also a young man named Ryan Walters running for superintendent of education. And they were saying that he might not make it or it would be a very short margin. But they both won by double digits, 12 to 14%.
I never bit. When they told us Kevin Stitt was in trouble, I never bit. I said, that's a broken poll. He was never even close. He's a very popular governor, isn't he?
He's a very popular governor. It came from the business sector from Tulsa. So, doing this for the first time, meeting the challenges of dealing with the administrative state and working with the legislature, all new things. And fortunately, did very well those first 4 years, and yes, a very popular governor. There were certain interest groups that would prefer to have had him not
the get tribes. I cover it very closely because I think the tribal ruling that came out of Justice Gorsuch is nuts, and he knows I think it's nuts, and I hope it's reversed. It's been sort of reversed already. What is on the agenda in Oklahoma? Supermajorities, a Republican governor, a good conservative, and Kevin Stitt. What do you guys want to get done this year?
Well, I know from the governor's point of view, tax reform is important, and also more school choice, more school reform, more putting parents in charge of the dollars. We tried that last year, and we didn't get very far with it. Sometimes when you're a supermajority, it's actually more difficult to advance some policies than it is when you absolutely have to stick together on every vote. So those are two things. The governor still wants to pursue making us very attractive to business. Obviously, we compete with our larger state to the south. But that is slowly changing as people start looking north and coming across the Red River and wanting to do more in our state. So he wants to make sure that we as a legislature adopt business-friendly practices. Again, looking at our tax code is very important. So those are two things which, not unlike what other states want to look at as well. And in terms of tax reform, that may take a little bit more doing because there's so many ways to approach that. And every state is different. We have a particularly populist constitution with lots of things in it that other states don't have that we have to work around.
And now, Senator Daniels, when I was living in California, Rick Perry was then governor of Texas. He would come over to my state with Velcro fingers on, take businesses out. Greg Abbott's doing the same thing now. So I assume that Oklahoma wants to put the Velcro on their fingers and get people to move. It's very affordable. I went down there for a Hobby Lobby event, do a talk down there
wonderful
for the
company.
Association of Christian Employers. And it is a wonderful place to do business. How can you possibly improve on that business climate?
Well, you can always look at your policies and make sure that they are better aligned with the interests of those who, first of all, you want to retain business. You want to grow what you have. Hobby Lobby is a very, very good example, an excellent employer. We love having them being an Oklahoma business. But I know what the governor said. He used this, I think, probably maybe a year or so ago when Governor Newsom was trashing Oklahoma for some particular policy. It may have been our pro-life policies. And he gave Governor Newsom the Economic Development Award for Oklahoma. Because, of course, the more you hear that from some of the blue states, the more, particularly those smaller companies, let's look at that size company, they look at moving to Oklahoma, bringing some people with them. But, of course, hiring people in Oklahoma and our cost of living is good. We're center of the United States. We've got great, you know, the interstates. The
housing is wonderful, affordable, and plentiful.
Yes, when we had the port of Catoosa, we actually do have a port. And so there's not anything you can't do
from
Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. Oklahoma has a port?
Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. What's the name of it?
Well, Port of Catoosa is what I call it.
I had no idea.
Yes.
So now
yes.
I do. Now, talking about school choice, because in Ohio, Governor DeWine, many people have been listening this morning, told me the biggest obstacle to school choice in Ohio are rural public schools because they do everything for a county and the counties love their unified school district. When you say Oklahoma's sort of done some stuff, where is Oklahoma? What more do you hope to get done?
We have an opportunity scholarship program in Oklahoma. Individuals and businesses may make donations to nonprofit organizations. One is run by the Catholic schools. One is run by independent schools. And you make donations to that. You get a tax credit. And then those scholarships go to these different schools to hand out to students to make their private education more affordable. So you can designate which school will get your dollars, but you don't donate the money to the school. You don't choose the child who gets the scholarship. Couple of thousand kids in Oklahoma are able to benefit, but the demand is much greater than the tax credits will allow. Now, in 2019, I think it was 19, we pushed to raise the cap on that. It had been something like $5 million. And we pushed it up to, I think it was $50 million. And we included public school foundations in this. So if you want to support your local public school district through a tax deductible or a tax credit scholarship donation, you can. So that's very good for our state. But that's certainly not universal school choice, saying, moms and dads, we understand now that we take in the taxes to educate your child, not to support necessarily any particular system. And so where you think your child could do better, you're a homeschooler, you want to use those dollars to help pay for that homeschool curriculum. You want to band with other parents to put together a small group. The issue about rural Oklahoma is that, first of all, most children, the vast majority, are going to continue to go to their public school. But what if somebody spun off and did a little something in a community? That competition's good for everyone. That will improve our public schools, and that will help salvage some of these kids for whom the public education just doesn't suit them.
Yeah, I had a friend in Texas, longtime state legislator, now retired. So it's nobody on the Texas payroll right now. Say, are you nuts? We love our football, and we're not going to take apart our football by opening up school choice. I said, I actually don't think that'll happen. I think people just go to the public school that works. It may up their game, not their football game, but their education game. But that interest group is real. Is that also an issue in Oklahoma where they might play a little football down there?
Oh, we do play a little football. Night lights are very important in our state, and I do get that. That's part of the culture of rural Oklahoma and our small towns, and nobody wishes to challenge that. We just have to look at individual kids. And if you have a handful of kids in your system who could do better elsewhere, How does that damage anything? How does that do anything but raise well-educated Oklahomans? You want them to become tax-paying citizens. You want them to want to stay in Oklahoma. If they're struggling, they only get one crack at it. You can't put the kid on the shelf and go fix public education and make it perfect and take another decade. You have to let moms and dads who are much more aware now where their child might not be getting the services that they think that they should have. So let's put it back on moms and dads.
And where they might thrive.
Correct.
Right. Now, the federal government, I heard it again yesterday. There are 8,000 drilling permits out there. The Biden administration says, oh, we're pro-energy. There are 8,000 permits. I point out a permit is not a drill. Forward advancing. They look ahead to the green energy agenda. They know that they're not going to put the capital because there's a lot of capital. What is the Oklahoma energy industry doing right now? And does the federal government get in the way or does it help?
It's interesting. I was asking some energy leaders about what is it like when you actually go and speak with the federal government? Outside of the media, outside the talking points, outside the no fossil fuels for anybody, anytime, and let's all, you know, live by candlelight. And they said that they can be reasonable. They do understand the issue. It's not as if you're having to start from scratch and teach these people how we do rely on fossil fuels, how much cleaner they are, how we are doing such a good job at cleaning and making our environment even better. And so the Oklahoma energy industry is very engaged in that. But of course, they have to be careful in how they proceed because they have an image now that's been painted as negative. And so they have to be super careful about the way they present themselves. But you can imagine in Oklahoma, it doesn't sit well with us. In fact, we passed legislation this last year to make sure that we do not invest any of our state funds with any institutions that have decided to divest themselves of oil and natural gas and other energy.
I was about to bring up ESG, and it does impact oil producing. In fact, I read yesterday that Sam Brownback got debanked. Not sure why he got debanked, probably because he's on the Alliance Defending Freedom board, but we're not sure for sure. He won't comment. And this ESG is going to screw states like Oklahoma that are energy producers. So how is Oklahoma fighting back?
Well, as I said, we passed legislation to say we will not invest any of our state funds in those who try to divest themselves of energy stocks. And we, you know, they're a critical part of our budget. Yes, it's volatile. Yes, it's a commodity market. But in a good year, I mean, a lot of our appropriations, you know, come through the taxes on the energy industry. So they're critical partners and, of course, wonderful employers. And while we may not be the state where most of the drilling is taking place, you know, we're a center for many companies that are exploring and producing elsewhere. We're center of a lot of their operations.
Aren't you pipeline central?
Yes, we are. Cushing, Oklahoma is pipeline central. That's very, very important to us. And I represent an area that major employers are Phillips 66, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, Phillips, ABB, because in my community, the oil industry began in the late 1800s where I live. And so we're still an energy community, even though we're not. No, none of these large companies are drilling right there.
When I tell people about the Biden administration and they say these permits, I said, talk to them about pipelines because they're, you know, not just Keystone, just pipelines. Pipelines are what you need to not only build, you've got to keep them up to speed and you got to invest in them. And this administration is not very energy friendly. How does most of the revenue come in Oklahoma? Is it by income tax, by estate tax, by sales tax, or by severance tax from oil?
Yes. Income tax and sales tax are the bulk. Energy can come right behind that. Again, that's fairly volatile, but I would say that's number three. We don't have an estate tax in Oklahoma.
We do not have
a statewide property tax in Oklahoma, which is why tax reform can sometimes be a challenge for us. Other states have that, and we don't. But your question was about energy. No, they are very critical to our economy. And even though we have diversified, in fact, aeronautics is now the second largest industry in Oklahoma. People aren't aware of that.
I didn't know you had a port and I didn't know you had an aeronautics.
You have anybody who has an engineering degree, wants to work in aeronautics, please come to Oklahoma. The Department of Commerce would like to have your name and number. We can't produce enough of it.
Senator Daniels, we need to put you on a billboard for Oklahoma.
You love my state. I love my state. We're a great state. You know, we're in the heartland and people like to poke fun at you. And the more they poke fun at being in the heartland and flyover company, you know, the stronger it makes you. That's why coming to ALEC is so much fun because you get to be with like-minded people legislating in their states. And, you know, we're all happy warriors, not only for our own states, but for our country.
Well, states that begin with the letter O just generally
rule.
They're
really good,
aren't
they?
And then the
Oklahoma,
other ones.
Yes.
Yeah. Senator Daniels, thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure.
This morning.
Thank you, sir.
I'll be right back. America State Senate President Karen Fan from Arizona joins us next
on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt from downtown D.C., where the ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, is working. Senate President Karen Fine Jones, me from Arizona, Senator. Welcome back. First, let's do with the politics. I think this election's over. I know there are some challenges, et cetera, but you got to prepare to deal with Governor-elect Hobbs.
That's correct.
And this is going to be a difficult. She's just not going to win the spelling bee. What are you going to do?
Well, you are correct. Unfortunately, it looks like we may be stuck with her, and it's a shame because it was our race to lose. Sorry. But we did lose, it appears. And so I think she's going to be a lame duck governor for the next 4 years. Luckily, we kept control majorities in the House and the Senate. So, you know, the only way she's going to try and get anything done is probably executive order or having to do some major bartering on things.
Can they in any way obstruct the Arizona revolution in school choice? Because that is, to me, it's a big state. It's a complicated state. You and the governor and the House got it all done. Any way she can undo that?
Not really. I mean, they can try and force it back to the ballot again, but that's why we're so glad that initial challenge, legal challenge, was thrown out of the courts a few months ago. So that gave us 2 years for people to get in the system, because once people are in the system, it's real hard to tell their parents, sorry, we're yanking you out.
And so how does it work in here? I'm really focused today on the Arizona model, and I think I know how it works, but you're the state Senate president. You tell us, Senator.
It's basically backpack funding. It means that the money goes with the kid, and which is so great because it means that parents actually get to make the best decisions for their kids. If the parents want them to go to public school because there happens to be a good public school in their area, then great. We support that. But if your kids have special needs, whether they accelerate or they need a little extra care, whether their public school is not the best school around or they're not the safest school, this gives them the opportunity to make those choices that are best for them.
So $6,000 per student,
uh-huh,
right? And it goes
correct.
Into an account that the parents can't use for other than education.
There are very strict rules. The ESA accounts, you can use them for books. You can use them for homeschooling. You can use them for tutoring. Sorry, it's early today. And consequently, it goes towards tuition or anything that it deals with.
So what happens to a public school that sees their population drop by 20%?
In Arizona, for the most part, there are formulas, but for the most part, they will lose a cut of that pay because you don't get to keep getting the same amount of money if you're going to have the less students or customers in this case.
Did you give them the ability to lay off teachers if in fact they have to downsize?
Oh, they always have that ability. Yeah, we're not a heavy union state.
Okay, so they can just right-size their school, and the ones who are there will probably get a better education than they did before when they were. If they get rid of the surplus administrators and the variety of bureaucrats that we know that attend every public school district now. What about your flat tax? That's a big deal. Arizona's drawn in people. What is the flat tax right now, and can Katie Hobbs ruin it?
It's 2.5%, and she can try, and again, try and force it to the ballot, try and force it to somewhere else. But right now, it's in law. And once again, once it takes effect, it's real hard for somebody like that to say, by the way, I'm going to raise your taxes again. So it will be extremely difficult with her having no control over the Senate and the House. So
what is the margin in the Senate? What is the margin in the House?
One-person margins.
In both House and Senate.
Yeah.
So,
but that's how we got ESAs and the flat tax done, with one-person margins.
Did you really?
Yes, we did.
You held your majorities?
We did.
And everyone said okay.
Yeah. Now, it cost us a little bit. That's a two-edged sword when you have one-person
majorities,
yeah. Right?
Everyone's the vote, right?
That's right. Everybody knows they're number 16 or number 31. But the other edge of that sword is we know that everybody has a price. So, and they use it. They utilize that. But that means that
everyone's got an agenda item that they want done. And so you got to
right.
get everybody's agenda item on the table and shuffle the cards, right?
That's exactly
right. How long have you been the Senate president?
I'm in my second term, fourth year.
And does everyone trust you? I mean, how do you manage that?
I think so. It's just a matter of consensus building. I've been doing politics for about 26 years now. I'm an owner of a highway construction company with 40 employees. So consequently, I've dealt with people quite a bit. And it's just letting everybody have their say. Everybody's not going to always be 100% happy because maybe they didn't get their way 100%. But I've always tried to be fair and always make sure that everybody had a voice.
It's such a difficult job when everybody's got a veto. And that is an extraordinary thing. Senator Sinema is much on the minds of people here. She saved the Constitution last year by not agreeing to do away with the filibuster. Any chance she just keeps on moving to the right? We got a minute left. I'm just curious.
I doubt she'll move to the right, but Kristen is a very, very smart lady. She is smart on her own rights, but also smart politically. And she knows her Arizona voters. And everybody keeps saying, oh, great, we'll go after her in the next election. And I'm like going, you're probably not going to beat her. I mean, she is very, very smart. She knows her voters, and she knows exactly how far left and how far right she can go.
Any chance that she puts on the red jersey?
I seriously doubt it. I seriously doubt it. She's been a dye in the wool.
Even though there's going to be a primary challenge from the left-wing nutters there?
I think it actually helps her because she can show just how reasonable she is.
How interesting. Senator Phan, thank you. Good luck in managing your caucus of your majority of one.
Thank you.
You must be a magician.
No, just we all work together. And like I said, it's always building that consensus.
Arizona is still open for business, America. And boy, if I was starting a business, it wouldn't be in California. It would be in the desert state. Thank you, Senator. I'll be right back, America. Hour number three from the ALEC conference right after this. I have come to ALEC, but ALEC actually came to me. ALEC is having its meeting inside the Beltway, the American Legislative Exchange Council. I last saw them in Atlanta when I went to them, but ALEC has come to the Beltway. This makes for an easy remote, the easiest remote I've ever done. And I'm joined by Senator Jim Dotson from Arkansas. He is the ALEC Policy Vice Chair. I'm not sure what that means, Senator, but welcome. It's good to have another Arkansan on beside Tom Cotton, who just clogs up my airways once a week. And so I know he's listening right now, but Senator Cotton is a regular here, and he tells us always about Arkansas. So now I get to actually talk to an Arkansan legislator.
He's a great guy.
He is.
We're
a wonderful.
Glad to have him.
Tell me something about the policy vice chair. Why did you agree to do it? You're not busy enough. I'm sure you're busy in Arkansas.
Well, I mean, it's just one more hat you wear when you come to one of these events. Talking about policy all the time, so might as well talk about policy to a larger audience a couple of times a year when we have these meetings. And then outside of the time, there's not really. I mean, we're working on policy in Arkansas. That's Arkansas specific most of the time. I just bring some of those great ideas to share with ALEC, and hopefully the rest of the country can adopt the great things we're doing.
Your governor-elect's a friend of mine, and
okay.
She's terrific. She's firecracker. And so Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders is going to take over. What does she want to get done? What do you want to get done with her?
I think some of the top things that they're on her agenda and have been on mine for the last 10 years I've been in the legislature have parental empowerment and education. So making sure the dollars follow the students to make sure the students have the best education opportunity that fits their specific needs. So everybody learns a little bit differently. You can't put education, everybody in one box of education and make sure that they're getting the right outcomes all the time. So the dollars have to follow the students to make sure that they can learn to read, to write, to do all the things they need to do. And parents should be the ones making those decisions on those dollar allocations to make sure that their student is receiving the best education possible for their specific student.
Now, Senator, we've got the Arizona model. We've got the West Virginia model. We've got people like Corey DeAngelis running around the country with a policy program.
He's a good friend.
For everybody. Corey's wonderful. He's terrific. What plan do you see happening in Arkansas? Because there's a variety of school choice plans in there. School choice minimum and school choice maximum. Where is Arkansas going to come down?
Well, that's obviously going to remain to be seen what the debate will be and what we can get through various committees and through the legislative bodies. My personal preference is going to be something probably more along the lines of Arizona model, where it's universal school choice options for parents, that we have, like I said, the dollars following the students, but we have the most robust options available for parents everywhere in the state that they can exercise for their kids.
Now, I've talked to so many people about this. I always hear one thing, whether it's Governor DeWine or anybody else, is that rural school districts have one high school and they got a unified school district and they don't want to lose their, because they love it. It's their football team. It's their whole identity. They know their local, you know, like I'm a John F. Kennedy High School, Warren, Ohio guy. I'm all into it. What do you do about those districts? How do you make sure they're not hurt?
Well, the options for parents in that have limited options outside of their local public school district are going to be a lot more challenging. However, we do still have a lot of parents right now, whether they're being supported or not, are exercising options. Many of them just pull their kids out of school and they're not getting educated.
So they're getting homeschooled.
They're getting homeschooled, sometimes with or without support, sometimes to varying degrees of ability to buy curriculum and exercise those options. So if we have some support for those parents, then hopefully those kids will have better options, more options. There is also, there can be options for micro school, type options where, maybe you have a tutor that takes on 2, 3, 4, 5 students at a time and is able to actually have a certified teacher that is teaching rather than, having somebody that doesn't have any formal education training.
In that Arizona system, I can see someone who wants to tutor 6 kids and really change, and they will get $36,000 with which to run a classroom.
Absolutely.
For 9 months, and they will go into any community, and they just want 6 kids. They might be in 10th and 11th grade. They might be 3rd and 4th grade. But the market will provide solutions.
Absolutely.
But how do you keep the infrastructure going so that big public school, for which, the local titans, whatever it is, that doesn't collapse by loss of
well, there's always dozen. Ebbs and flows, and particularly in rural areas, we're seeing a lot of them shrink already. So if you have more options for students and parents to stay locally, you might have the local economy continue to thrive and grow at a faster rate. We're seeing a large exodus of people from cities into rural communities already. And if you provide them with more robust opportunities to be able to work from home, to work remotely in a rural environment and setting, and their kids can also have various options, your local economy will increase. Those local property taxes still stay with the local district, regardless of whatever happens with school districts. So on a per pupil basis, some students or some rural schools will actually have more money to allocate toward fewer students. So those robust options and opportunities provide competition, and that competition makes the local superintendents and school districts have to compete and worked more proactively to make sure that their programs are attracting the students.
Now, Senator, in this town, the lobbyist, you can't throw a stone without hitting a lobbyist. I'm not sure what it's like in Arkansas or Little Rock or in Bentonville, but how do you actually craft do you sit down with your colleagues and actually write out the law, or are there, legions of lobbyists in Arkansas as well?
Yes.
Okay. Both. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there are some folks that are much more interested in the minutiae of the details of policy that you sit down and you talk with. Obviously, the various associations, i.e. unions, they always want to have a seat trying to influence the various components of legislation. So at the end of the day, you've got sausage that gets made in some way, shape, or form, and you try to cobble together enough support for whatever it is in order to pass it. And so I can't tell you the details of what it will look like on the end, but in a broad sense, I think the plan is to do something more like what Arizona is doing, what West Virginia is doing, and some of these states that have led in the past. And
did you just move to the Senate? After 10 years
in
the House?
Actually, I'm still in the House until January.
Until January. And so what do you expect is going to be the difference?
Smaller body, bigger personalities.
Okay. So how many people are in the Arkansas State Senate?
We've got 35 state senators, 100 House members. So it'll be one-third of the size.
Of those 35, how many are Republicans?
29.
Okay. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And we've got 82 out of 100 in the House. So super majorities in both chambers.
So you can do with the governor whatever you want to get done.
Whatever the leadership can get members to go along with and vote for. I think the governor will always carries a large policy bat. I won't even say a stick in the state.
A club.
That has, yeah.
A
so
club.
So I think Governor Sanders will have or Governor-elect Sanders, I guess at this point, she will have a large amount of support, having won, I think, almost 63% of the vote in Arkansas in a mandate to get some of her key issues, which, you know, she wants to move to 0% income tax. We're not going to get there overnight, but over the period of time, that continues to be a push and a goal.
Now, Florida doesn't have any income tax.
Right.
And Tennessee doesn't have any income
tax. Neither does Texas.
And neither does Texas. So that kind of puts you in a position, if you want to compete in the New South, you got to get to zero.
Well, Arizona just went to 2.5% flat tax.
Yeah.
So we have worked very hard over the, by time in the House. We've gone from a 7% top income tax rate down to 4.9.
Okay.
And so we've been chipping away at it, and we are running massive surpluses still. And so it's a matter of just trying to willpower and getting it done to try to get
surpluses
us down.
Surpluses in Arkansas?
Oh, yeah. We have a little over $6 billion budget, and right now I think we have around a $2.8 billion fund. We had a $1.6 billion surplus last year, and a $900 million to $1 billion surplus in the year prior. And we cut $500 million in annual taxes this year.
And so I'm in favor of giving that back. That's my general reflection. If you've got a surplus, that should go back to the people. Yeah. Are there some Republicans that don't agree with me?
Well, yeah, there are some that I'm not one of those. I want to make sure that we're taking care of the needs that we have with some of those one-time funds and making sure that we continue to have a robust economy going forward. But I am one of the ones that is pushing toward getting our income tax rates or corporate income tax rates and all those down as low as possible, down to zero eventually.
Senator Dodson, thank you so much. The word from Arkansas is good. Greet the governor-elect for me, would you?
Will do. Thank you very much.
I'll be right back. America from D.C. and ALEC.org. Stay tuned. Is there any American who doesn't know what this music is from? Lee Beeb is sitting in the room with me, and I think he's written about Peanuts Christmas before. Can you give Lee your microphone? I can't remember what your column was, but we're playing the Charlie Brown Christmas song right now. What was your column about Peanuts?
It was about what Charles Schulz went through back in the 60s as he made this classic and didn't know it was a classic. Coca-Cola had basically pitched them and said, hey, could you make a Charlie Brown's Christmas? And the guy who was pitching said, yes. And they said, well, how long will it take? And he said, well, you got a week. And so in a week...
In
a week, they put this together. But they ran into a few snags. For instance, there was no laugh track. And the executives at CBS didn't like that. The kids were doing the voiceovers, not adults. And there was not an adult voice in it. The only time we hear from an adult is wah, wah, wah. The music was a beautiful jazz soundtrack. It was Vince Guaraldi. And the suit said, huh. So no laugh track, jazz. And then there was this scene from Luke, reading from Luke.
Linus.
And so when it goes to CBS, the executives go, oh, this religion thing during Christmas. This is 1965, when Time Magazine's about to put on their cover,
God is dead.
Yeah. Right? And so Charles Schulz says, look, it stays. It stays. And so they were ready to write it off. Like Americans didn't want to hear about Christmas during Christmas time and the birth of Jesus. And of course, it gets a 50 share. 50% of Americans watched it and it got a re-up.
50 share.
Now there were only three networks, okay? So you got an automatic 33 share.
You know, in my PBS days, if we had a half share, it was a home run.
It was a big deal.
In my PBS days, if we had a half share. And today,
50 share.
Can you imagine a 50 share at MSNBC or at Fox? I mean, no, they get a 2% share. Share at Fox. A 50 share. Do you rerun that column every year?
Every year.
And Newsweek, where does it show up? National Newsweek. Every year?
Yep.
Go and get that. Leah Beeb, A Charlie Brown Christmas. And since we're talking about Christmas, let me remind everyone, Angel Tree needs your help. In fact, let me play for you the tape of a mom in prison in California about what Angel Tree does for her and her kids.
Angel Tree is a blessing. Since my incarceration, Angel Tree is the reason why I've been able to give my son gifts. Angel Tree sponsors it. I'm able to put my name on it and write a special note. If you're unable to make it to like a place like this, they'll still mail it to you. Or you can go to a church that's in your neighborhood. So my mom, she usually goes to this church down the street and picks up the gifts. So it's been amazing. Angel Tree is the best.
You know, it is the best. And the deal is those parents have no money. And so if you're a jailed inmate, you haven't got $30 to give a present. You haven't got $10 to give a present. That's on you. That's on me. That's why the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I always support Angel Tree. That's why I hope you will go to HughHewitt.com and hit the banner at the very top. I can't believe Gallagher has more people contributing than me. I can't believe that. That's an offense to the world and to my dignity. So I'm asking my audience to please rally and get ahead of Mike. But more importantly, rally for these kids. There are 1.5 million kids who have one or both parents in jail this Christmas. Angel Tree is a ministry of prison fellowship. They've been doing it for decades. They're very good at it. You can call them if you want. You can call Angel Tree at 888-206-2764, 888-206-2764, or just go to HughHewitt.com. Wait a second, you Steelers fans. The banner loads at the top. It takes a second. You'll see it's a cartoon. Now, let me tell you, I wrote Andrew Del Rey last night from AndrewandTodd.com because a news flash came across that the Federal Housing Authority has raised the amount of loan guarantee they will do on a home up to $1 million, which I thought, wow, Andrew, does this make a difference? And Andrew wrote me back, does it make a difference? Because finally, people are able to get FHA loans, which help you with the down payment, lower down payment. But if you're living somewhere where the houses are seven figures, if you're living in the middle of New York City or you're living in the middle of L.A. and you're trying to get a house and you've got it's a $1 million house and you've scraped together $50,000 to put 5% down, but you're young and you're making money, but you can't afford. You just got to be able to do a small down payment. FHA will now help you get in. But to do that, call AndrewandTodd.com, 888-888-1172. They're at Sierra Pacific Mortgage. They've been helping people buy houses for 20 years. Sierra Pacific has never changed their name. They're the same they've been for 20 years. Andrew Del Rey, Todd Abakian, good friends of mine. They've done all of our loans, done Dwayne's loan. Call them, 888-888-1172, 888-888-1172. Come back. More from Alec. The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC.org, rich state, poor state. We continue after this on The Hugh Hewitt Show from the heart of the Beltway. Stay with us.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
You know whose chestnuts are in the fire right now, America? Dwayne. I really do not have a producer. If I had a producer, I would not have a Steelers fan in the room. I would not have a University of Michigan fan in the room. I would have someone who knew something about football and who wasn't from Pennsylvania in the room. But instead, I have State Representative Seth Grove from Pennsylvania, who we're going to try and be civil to, despite the fact he opens up. How about those Wolverines? Honest to goodness, Seth, first of all, what do you represent? Beaver Falls? What are you from?
Right. So I'm from South Central Pennsylvania, so your county just below Harrisburg. So when you talk football, it's actually three main groups. So there's Steelers, there's Eagles, and then there's Ravens. We have some Redskins, I guess.
Ravens,
yeah. So we have a lot of people that left Maryland as refugees and came to York. It's literally Little Baltimore. The former Governor Ehrlich, His mom lives in southern York County.
First of all, let me say, you've got a terrific radio voice, so I don't want you anywhere near. Doesn't he have a terrific? It's unique. It's a unique voice. I don't know. How do you describe it, Dwayne?
It's a very good voice. That's why I booked him.
No, I usually say I have a great face for radio.
No,
so, I mean,
well, I've got that. Yeah. Now tell me, Seth, how did you end up being a University of Michigan fan?
So I was a basketball player in high school, the Fab Five. I love the trend setting. Right. It was great. I love seeing Juwan Howard back at the school. And I love that University of Michigan football team's 2-0 against Ohio State. After
they are not
2-0.
They are 3-17 over the last 20 years. Now, Ryan Day might have a little Michigan problem in his head now. A little bit of a Michigan problem in his head.
He broke down. I do not think he was as aggressive as he should have been. Ohio State wide receivers are phenomenal. Harrison Jr., oh, my God.
They prepared a defense to beat Corum. And then he didn't play, and they didn't change the defense.
Right.
And so there are three broken plays. Yeah. And then Ryan Day wants to establish the run. They're down to their fourth running back.
Right.
Don't get me started.
I appreciate all that coaching. Keep him. He's like John Cooper. He's great.
That is so slanderous. Only Ohio people know how slanderous. And John Cooper's a fine man, but honest to goodness, not a good man.
Was there an election in Pennsylvania recently?
I don't know. But there's a lot of football to talk about here. So let's just do one more football thing.
Yeah.
The Steelers are now in quarterback hell, where the Browns have been forever until Deshaun Watson shows up this weekend. Are you giving up on the kid you picked with the small hands?
That's actually when I heard that, I'm like, is Trump in that? Is that small hands? I don't know. It's interesting.
I didn't know Marco Rubio played football.
Right. I don't know what you do to remedy that. I mean, you look at the Jets, you know, they pulled back their kind of elite quarterback they drafted. I think it's Matt Canada. I think it's the coaching. I really do.
You can believe that. It's right. The quarterback.
Right.
Good luck with that. Yeah.
You know, Trubisky is not bad.
Stay right where you are for the next 20 years. 20 years. Just be like the Browns.
Happy, right.
Just make the Browns your model. Let's get to politics. Josh Shapiro is a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. So I got to start by full disclosure. The Attorney General and Governor-elect and I are on speaking terms, and we get along fine. I think he's going to be on the national ticket in 2024. I told everyone he's going to be the vice presidential candidate in 2024, unless he completely steps on a rake. Right. What's going to happen in Pennsylvania? Because I think you have a majority in the state Senate, right?
Yeah. So it's really interesting in the House. We're 101, 101, and a dead guy.
No.
So
Does the dead guy vote in Pennsylvania like Illinois?
Possibly. Yeah, so you can vote dead. You can get elected dead.
There are 200 people?
203 House members.
You're kidding me. Pennsylvania could be that dysfunctional.
Well, the thought process was we had less a few decades ago. Then we had a constitutional convention, and the citizens decided we need to add more House members so they can't be bought off by the railroad barons so easily. So they figure more people. Takes more money to buy them off, and everything will be great. I don't think that worked, but it was an interesting theory. So we have one of the largest legislatures in the country.
So you have 101 to 101 and a dead person.
Right. So Tony DeLuca passed away. It was too late to remove him from the ballot. So I think he had like a Green Party, something like that. So he got like 80% of the vote. People loved him. Great guy. He wore like the bright suits. He's just a good dude. So then we'll have two other openings. Josh Shapiro's Lieutenant Governor Austin Davis is a House member.
Okay.
So he'll resign when he gets sworn in end of January. And then we have Summer Lee, all three Pittsburgh based seats. Summer Lee.
So they're not losing anything in terms of brain power.
Right. Right. So
you just said right. There goes your statewide campaign. Right.
That's fine. So Summer Lee, she won for Congress, so she's getting sworn in the same day we are. So potentially we can control the House for 6 months, and then you have the special elections come up. They're primarily Democrat seats, but special election, we'll see what happens. Get good candidates, maybe. So that's kind of
Months, are you going to try and do a budget and get the new governor to sign on to it?
Well, we'll see. It's going to be interesting to see how Josh does stuff. You know, I served with Josh in the House. I worked with him when he was as Attorney General on some Medicaid reform, anti-fraud bills. I've always found him. You're able to work with.
He's a smart guy,
right? He's smart. He's capable. So we'll see where he wants to go. Like he absolutely has that ambition to get on that national ticket, whether it's president, vice president.
He demurs with me.
Right.
Oh, I'm just want to run the Keystone State. I'm sure he does.
Right.
But he wants to be on that national ticket.
Yeah,
and
he really
does. Very staunch supporter of Israel. Mm-hmm. He's kind of like an old Scoop Jackson Democrat who's shown up in Pennsylvania, washed up by the tides of time. We've got a throwback guy.
Right. And it's going to be interesting because if the House Democrats get control, they're very. Their policies are very leftist, and they'll push him to the left. So it's really interesting. Like, does he really want them in charge?
Do you do a 2-year budget or a 1-year budget?
We do a 1-year budget.
Okay, I wonder if he wants to do a 2-year budget when he can deal with people in the Senate.
I would prefer that. I would prefer that. And he's going to have an issue. Like if I'm Kim Ward, President Pro Tem of the Senate, I'm going to go to Josh and say, listen, House D's are your problem. We're negotiating. When we get a deal, you go because I'm not dealing with them. So he's kind of stuck in a situation. So I don't know, how he's going to play this a little bit. Cause you know, I think he really wants to be like the preeminent leader governor, right? I had a Republican General Assembly. I got these Democrat policies, and I got these Republican policies done, you know,
and he wants to be Mr. Moderate Democrat,
right? Like,
it's a brand.
Right.
It's a brand.
Right.
So, and so how do you work? You know, you got an opportunity
coming
up, Seth, in terms of you've got a potentially ambitious governor who wants to put some markers down, can't get anything done unless he works with the Republicans.
Right.
That tells me school choice
right.
because your teacher union won't like it unless it's done the right way. What's the opportunity map look like in the Pennsylvania?
Yeah. So he actually came out. One of his platforms was a voucher program, a Lifeline scholarship. Like he literally listed it on there. He has said it multiple times and he frames it in. We need to make sure we take care of our public schools. So he'll ask for probably big funding like our current Governor Wolf has done, wrapped in probably with some of the school choice stuff. So he's going to go I want this and this.
Matches. Will you bite on that? Will you, as a Republican, bite on that?
Yeah, I think it's a actually a pretty good deal. We always fund education anyway.
Yeah. Like, get me a lifeboat is all I said. Get me a lifeboat to get kids out of failing schools.
Right. So I think that's important. I think we look at other stuff. We had an opportunity in New York to actually charter York City School District when Governor Corbett was kind of leaving office. Governor Wolf was coming in. There was a recovery officer in charge, and they kind of put this plan together. Governor Wolf and his wife started the first charter school in York and ended up going the complete opposite direction when he became governor. And, you know, the hope from Meckley was, you know, I'm going to hold off on this until Governor Wolf. He said he's going to be supportive. And then Wolf pulled him out, put somebody else in it, and never got chartered. And it's like the high school's on the worst performing list for multiple years. At one point, it was, we have 500 school districts. It was 499.
500 school 500. Districts?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, my God. The Keystone State is so screwed up in some respect. It's also a pro-gun state. People don't know this. I grew up in eastern Ohio, 7 miles from Sharon. Mm-hmm. So I know Pennsylvania, and I know to stay away from it because they're all armed. What is Josh Shapiro going to do about guns?
It's going to be interesting. You know, we have a massive crime issue in the city of Philadelphia. Before we left, impeached Larry Krasner. He's the DA in Philadelphia. The Senate is accepting our managers today and tomorrow. Then they're going to finish up the trial next year. So it's a bad place. Philadelphia is a war zone. One of my colleagues here, some Philadelphia police showed a video happened just yesterday of a parking guy, the parking authority, writing tickets. Guy came up behind him, pulled out a gun, shot him in the head, drops down. Didn't know him, just a random act of violence. The guy's dead. Here's a guy that woke up in the morning, you know, could have a family, said, I love you to my wife, love you to my kids. Parking authority, right? Just writes tickets, not a police officer.
Did they arrest the gunman? Do you know?
I don't know. I think they're still looking for him.
All right. So there's obviously Philadelphia is a no-go zone.
Right.
And people don't like to go to, they're going to have the Army Navy game, but they're going to have it over at the sports complex. So it'll be somewhat safe. They can ring it with police.
Right.
But it didn't show up in the red wave. What happened?
Yeah. So there are multiple things that happened.
John Fetterman is your senator.
Right. Right. I've been getting a lot of that this week. What happened in Pennsylvania? I'm like, we're special. It's a special state. We're special, right? So I usually break it down with three things. So you have Donald, Doug, and Dobbs. Those were the three kind of underscoring political issues. So Pennsylvania, the kind of, say, moderate Republicans, independents, moderate Democrats do not like him.
Trump, right.
Trump. If he is president, if he's our ticket, he will lose Pennsylvania. There's no path.
I'm kind of writing Pennsylvania off because you have to be a moron not to put Josh Shapiro on as your vice president. Only a white male can't do that.
Right. Right.
But even a white male might say, I need Pennsylvania. Screw it. We did the Kamala Harris thing.
Right. So we'll see how that plays out. But those things drove it. Our gubernatorial candidate, Doug Mastriano, raised no money. He raised
terrible candidate.
Maybe $3 million to $27 million. Didn't do any commercials. And Josh smartly repeatedly said extremist Republicans. And he's the first kind of statewide candidate that impacted the entire ticket. Normally in the General Assembly, we can isolate ourselves from the top of the ticket and focus on, hey, you're like, we're your local state rep. We're your local person. But it had a direct impact. And then just a horrific discussion around abortion. The Dobbs case, we moved the constitutional amendment. It went from, you know, we want to put in a constitutional protection to make sure the Supreme Court on this stuff to you are going to lock moms and doctors and everybody up for abortion. So it was a big messaging issue.
And why didn't you get better at that?
Republicans in general aren't good at messaging.
Seth Grove, last question.
Yep.
Will your state party reform itself? It was a nightmare.
I hope so. Even look at the gubernatorial race. We had 9 candidates all the way to the end. We didn't have a clear majority, right? Doug, the winner, got 46%. So they need to do a lot of reforms, and we need to do better on mail-in ballot.
Seth Grove, come back some other time.
Really, you want me?
No, not really. Michigan Steelers fan, no.
Maybe we do a live at
the Big House. Two strikes and you're out, man. We're not. I've been to the Big House, and the only time I ever saw Ohio State play Michigan, I've never been to the Shoe. I saw them get Ohio State take it to the Wolverines in the Big House when I was law school there. It's the best game I've ever gone to. Seth Grove, you can come back if you don't talk about the Steelers. I'll be right back to wrap up today's Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172.
Have a holly jolly Christmas. It's the best time.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, wrapping up the first of 2 days at the ALEC conference with Senate President Ty Masterson from the great state of Kansas, Mike Pompeo's hometown, I think. Ty, welcome. It's great to have you here, Senator. What happened in Kansas?
Well, it's great to be here, Hugh. I mean, although that the red wave, you know, it kind of trickled a little bit on us, but it was really, we had some very unique circumstances. Republicans did very well in Kansas, except for our governor's race, which was a disaster, right? We had, I mean, it's a perfect example of how divided houses fall.
Yeah.
You know, we ended up with even a fourth candidate in the general race, somebody that actually left the Republican Party, unaffiliated, ran as a ticket. And it only took that little 2% to throw things off. But it was bigger than that. We had prior, you know, what you'd call the in-name only Republicans out on the media against it. And you had the luckiest, I think, governor in the world, our current incumbent. You got handed hundreds of millions of dollars of federal stimulus money. And so it was tripping around our state, cutting ribbons, you know. And so you had this general perception that things were okay, right? And
how long have you been in the legislature?
I was elected in 2005.
So you were on 17 years. And
yep.
So is this going to be an impossible to deal with situation, or will this governor, now a lame duck, work with you?
Oh, that's a great question. And we'll see. I mean, her natural tendencies are certainly progressive, right? I mean, particularly on the social side. I think the first thing she did after the election was make November, some date in November, Transgender Awareness Day, right? So she has those agendas. But on the fiscal side, I'm optimistic. I mean, it's going to be hard. We had big plans for a Republican governor. We were set up. I'd already worked with who's likely to be the incoming Speaker of the House. We had broad stroke ESA school choice set to go, flat tax. I mean, more election reform. That was all set to go and be signed in 30 days. So I mean, just several of us just kind of sick to our stomachs. We know we're still going to work on those issues because we have a one person supermajority. But that always, they always know they're the one person, right? If we got to, now we don't just have to pass.
So you can override a veto.
It's possible, but it's very difficult. We still have our edges that, you know, these three on this edge, if you got those three on that other edge in it.
It's like Kevin McCarthy land.
It's exactly Kevin McCarthy land. Yeah. You've lived it.
Yeah. And I watch it and I don't know what I would do. That's why I'm in radio. There's only Hugh Hewitt land, right?
Right.
The producer doesn't matter. I don't care. You go away. Don't say anything. So that's all that matters. I live in Hugh Hewitt land because I don't want to deal with anybody. The question becomes, though, when you have a Democratic governor, do you call her up and say, let's talk? What do you do?
I do. So a little bit of history on that. She used to be the ranking Democrat on a committee I chaired for several years.
Okay.
So we have a working relationship. She's not a tremendously difficult person. And so we have a one-on-one type relationship. And I am going to try. So just take your ESAs and school choice, where we wanted it to just be universal. I'm going to see if we can work with her to get it. Maybe it's just for those at-risk kids or
she
something.
Can't some want a kid trapped in a failing Wichita school to stay there, right?
Her difficulty is she's really beholden to kind of the union, right? The school
anymore.
Union.
Not anymore. She's done. There's no other job for her.
And so I'm hopeful for that, right? And that she doesn't take this last lame duck term and she really does do good things for Kansas instead of just goes and panders to the base.
Now, tell me about the Kansas Republican Party. I just talked to Seth about the Pennsylvania Republican Party. It's a disaster. It's like a blast zone. What about Kansas?
Yeah, I think we're disaster junior. I mean, we're the same. It's the
so
same
thing.
You
need a thing. State party chair. Can you find someone to run it and build it like it used to be? California's worse than anybody's.
We need to because that matters, right? That really matters. We have some really effective local, like county level GOP groups. Statewide's a bit of a problem. We still have that just division, and this election just dug that so deep. It's going to take some months to repair, right? I mean, everybody's second guessing everybody else and what went wrong, and this is what was wrong with the candidate or the campaign or the.
So is that your job to kind of lead from the middle of the party, not the middle of the political spectrum, but from the middle of the Republican Party?
Yeah, that's certainly the job, and some of the difficulty for me is I'm a very conservative person, right? I was told at one point, way too conservative to ever be president of the Senate, and I'm there. So, but now I'm working with the guys that sit here next to me, and they go, well, it looks like you're always working to your left. And I go, that's because everybody's to my left.
Yeah, that's actually kind of good. If you can stand up as the conservative about whom no one has any doubt and say, we got to do this deal because this is the art of the possible, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's my job. Right?
Where's your district?
Wichita.
It is Wichita.
It is Mike Pompeo's hometown. Right?
Is it? So, I guess.
Yeah, because... I knew Mike well until he went, I think, CIA. Then we lost his phone number.
I quoted him last night on Special Report because he's out there on Twitter. And so you got this Kansan. Are you supporting him for president?
I'd love to see I'll support whoever our Republican candidate is, period. I don't care who it is. But Mike would be great. I like DeSantis.
DeSantis. You're going to get a call from Pompeo this morning saying, what's going on, Ty?
I like both of them. I'd love to see a DeSantis-Pompeo ticket.
Honestly. I want them just both on the radio. That's all I care about. I just want them both on the radio.
Because they're both brilliant in their own right.
Now, the one-vote majority, does that last for the whole time, or do you have people die and then you lose it?
No, it'll last for my whole time.
Okay.
If somebody changes.
Are you term limited?
We're not.
You can be the president of the Senate for a long time?
We have something unique in Kansas. There's no term limit to your office, but once you hit the top spot, there's kind of been this tradition for the entire history of Kansas that you'll only do two terms.
I'll be the
spot.
FDR of Kansas. All right.
So, by the way, my clock's ticking.
I need Kansas State to beat TCU this weekend. So say your prayer. We need Ohio State in the Final Four.
I went to Kansas State, so I'm
go,
on your side. So.
Go, crush them. No one win gentleman stuff.
Like we did Oklahoma, right?
Crush them. Thank you, Ty. Thank you, Generalissimo. Thank you, Lee. Thanks to everyone from ALEC. I'll be back tomorrow with more from the American Legislative Exchange Council gathering in D.C. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Talk to you tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.